You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
It's been an important week in the continued battle against the COVID pandemic, with the J&J vaccine facing a hurdle that appears to be nothing more than a storm in a teacup, hopefully. While today, the second phase of the country's vaccination strategy kicked off with the electronic registration for over 60s. It's unclear at this stage whether the government's decision to pause the J&J vaccine rollout will have a material impact, given that it hasn't really started yet. An analysis published in a new World Bank report shows that vaccinating 60% of South Africa's population to induce so-called herd immunity will certainly have a benefit-cost ratio of more than 29, and that the economic benefits would be amplified by an accelerated vaccination rollout. I think that's fairly obvious. This while China's GDP jumped a record 18.3% in the first quarter from a year earlier, according to official data this morning, perhaps slower than the 19% forecast by economists in a Reuters poll. But following that 6.5% growth in the fourth quarter, it shows what a country can do as it bounces back from COVID-19. While the reading is heavily skewed by the plunge in activity a year earlier, the increase is the strongest since at least 1992, when official quarterly records started in China. Well, to review the week that was, I'm joined now by Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, Raymond Parsons, Professor in the School of Business and Governance at Northwest University, and a special guest this week, Stavros Nicolaou, Head of the Health Working Group for Business for South Africa. And Stavros, I'm not 60 just yet, so I haven't been able to test drive government's electronic registration system. How does it work as we enter this next phase?
Michael, firstly, thanks very much for having me back on your program. I think today is probably one of the most important days in this whole, 13 or 14 month COVID roller coaster that we've been experiencing in our country and globally, more broadly speaking. A real red letter day, because I think you can start to feel and touch the vaccination program going to into phase two, going into, jabs in the arms of people. The EVDS launched today. EVDS, incidentally, stands for Electronic Vaccine Data System, is the platform that the general population will use, starting, of course, with 60-year-olds first, and we can talk about the sequencing, if you wish, Michael, a little later, but starting with 60-year-olds from 4 p.m. and onwards today, they can go and download the EVDS app, enter their details, and they'll be recorded in the system. The system, the EVDS system, will then communicate back to the individual patient or vaccinee, more correctly put, as to the details of where they will eventually have to go and be vaccinated or be a vaccination site near either their place of work or their residence. And in some cases, it will probably even be the employer themselves that will present as a vaccination site. So this EBDS system is very important for the population because, and the general citizenry of the country, because they will start to feel and touch the vaccine program for the first time, given a number of setbacks that we've had in recent months. So today for me was really good news. And the EVDS system, very complicated system, it certainly doesn't only do scheduling of appointments for vaccinees. It covers a number of other important elements, such as stock management, the billing system eventually that will be used, and many other parameters as well.
Just to get the sequencing right, Stavros, and thanks for that introductory comment. If I have a look at the website, it has only one qualifying criteria at the moment. You've got to be 60 years or older for phase two. I did hear the health minister, though, talk about the fact that phase two is also for essential workers and people older than 18 with comorbidities. Can you just elaborate on that? Because it seems the registration process might need to be redesigned a little if you are presenting with one of those two criteria.
Michael, you're quite right. So we all know phase one is the phase that that would vaccinate all your healthcare workers. We've covered around 30% of the healthcare workers thus far. So from the 17th of May onwards, 17th of May to mid-November, we intend covering or vaccinating 17 million people, 17 million in phase two. Phase two, as you correctly point out, covers a number of segments of the population, starting from a sequencing point of view, starting off first with those that are 60 and older. That's the first category. Then you will move to the next category or segment of the population, which is those that are 18 and above and have a comorbidity, one or more comorbid states. These are COVID comorbid states, of course, things like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, etc. And within that group, there will be subsets. So you will probably have those that are 40 and comorbid or vulnerable going first, being sequencing ahead of those that are 18 and comorbid. And then you will work your way through essential workers and those that either reside or work in congregate settings. So there's a sequencing issue here. And of course, what we know definitively today is the first group that will go is those that are 60 or older.
And then just one last question before I bounce it off to you, Raymond, as someone who's going to be front of the queue, I'm sure, despite a full head of hair. Stavros, is the J&J vaccine. And what's happening with that? It's been paused in the US and it looks now like it might be a little bit longer than initially anticipated, just to get a handle on what's going on with the venous sinus thrombosis issues there. But only six people displaying critically out of 7 million doses seems to be very, very minute statistically. I mean, you've got higher chances if you take oral contraceptives, if you fly on a plane. Is this a bit of a storm in a teacup, or does this have a potential to delay our vaccine rollout?
Michael, firstly, I think it is a storm in a teacup. It's not unusual with any new pharmaceutical and or vaccine that you do experience some adverse events. In this instance, it's a really minuscule amount. I mean, my son was putting it in the calculator for me the other night, and it's decimals recurring. So it's not significant. But nonetheless, one does have to take guidance from SAHPRA, the South African Medicines Regulatory Authority called SAHPRA, and the Ethics Committee that also designs a study, because of course J&J has been rolled out in our country to 300,000 healthcare workers. There's been no incidence of any adverse events thus far. However, it is a study. There is an Ethics Committee that approves all these studies, and this Ethics Committee, together with SAHPRA, have taken a precautionary pathway here in that they are pausing this momentarily just to digest the data that presents before them. And then they will reconsider and hopefully press the unpause button, maybe as early as this weekend potentially. I'm hearing that SAHPRA will pronounce later on today or early evening on their findings and the way forward. But I think if you assess the statistics, as you correctly put it, we know that as a normal course of COVID, those patients that get COVID, 39 out of every million will experience the type of thrombosis that you've just mentioned, the cerebral venosinal thrombosis. Whereas with the Astra product, which has a similar delivery platform or a similar vaccine platform to that of J&J, the numbers have been significantly lower. So there's about a 39 times greater likelihood of you dying from a thrombosis, a cerebral thrombosis linked to COVID, than there is to using one of these vaccines. So I think that puts it all in perspective.
Absolutely.
For me, a little bit of a no-brainer.
Yeah, that's why I do consider it at this stage a storm in a teacup as well. Raymond, does this start building significantly more confidence now that we've reached this milestone? Because I know on the show over the last month or two, we have banged on this drum of getting the vaccine rollout speeded up. What do you make of where we find ourselves currently?
Well, I think, Michael, this is a very positive development, and it is confidence building at a stage where we obviously need it. As I think Stavros has said, it's been a roller coaster of uncertainty, ups and downs as to whether we're making progress on the issue of the vaccine. As I put it, we needed to weaponize the vaccine into a vaccination rollout. And it looks as if today there's the starter's pistol, if I can put it that way, in a serious way. I think it also, at the macro level, I would just like to make two points. The first is, I think it's a tribute to the strengthening of a concept of, indeed, the public-private sector partnerships on the health front. I think this is important. It's an important example, which I hope we will build on in other areas of our public policy. So I think that is certainly a huge positive and sends out a good message. My second is a question, given some of the micro numbers that have been mentioned by Stavros, let's just look into the crystal ball. The end of the year, what proportion of the population does he think will have received the vaccine? Mm. I think that would be, give us some kind of benchmark over which we'll be working over the next few months. I wonder if you could throw some light on what is the target for, say, the end of the year.
Absolutely. Stavros, let's throw it back to you.
The estimate here is that by mid-November 2021, which is not that far away if you think about it, we would have vaccinated around 18 million people. That's almost half of the number you are required to vaccinate. But importantly, Prof, in that 18 million are your more highly vulnerable segments of the population. So these are the people that are more likely to become either severely or critically ill, overwhelm health services and facilities. And of course, what we've seen and learned both in our own country and around the world is when you start overwhelming the health services, that's when you get more drastic down measures coming into place, which shut down the economy. So I think by mid-November, we're going to be in a really good space. And I think the economy will be opening up significantly by then or even before then. So it's a really positive development what happened today. And by mid-November, I think we'll be in a really good space as a country.
Warwick, from your vantage point, looking at the way the markets might be viewing this news at this stage, we've already seen that the South African market over the last 12 months has been the best performing market globally in dollar terms. Further tailwinds now on the back of this news.
I think it's important to remember now, both in the likes of stock market data and any other economic data in the next few months, we are going to be dealing with prior base effects because if you recall, it was COVID first appeared in China in January. It spread to Europe in basically early to mid-February. And we then had our first case in South Africa, if I recall, on the 5th of March. But I mean, the only real traction was frankly after lockdown around about in mid-April when it really got going. But the key point is this, is that COVID always has been a law of large numbers disease. You had to pick your poison. Sometimes government picked it right, sometimes it picked it wrong. But the point was you had to say, where were the statistics going to fall? It's going to be the same with vaccination program and the same with the candidates for the vaccination program. I expect in the end, we're probably going to look at an occasionally uncomfortable mix between ballet and hockey. But the key point is to get as many done as fast as possible, because stopping the various points of spread is really what we need to achieve here.
Yeah, and I was having a look at economic forecasts with the trio of economists midweek, Raymond, and the consensus was probably for growth of around 3.5%. It's pretty much in line with what you were saying recently. Would you perhaps add on a couple of perhaps decimal points on the back of what we just heard from Stavros Nicolaou to that?
Well, I think, Michael, the problem is that we're always adding decimal points. I wish we could get beyond these small decimal points about economic welfare. Let me just quickly use an example. I spoke to a Chinese economist I know in the last few days about their very huge increase of 80% in their GDP in the first quarter of this year. He said to me, oh, you know, Professor Parsons, this is a big problem. How are we going to sustain this? You know, it does create huge problems. I said, give me that problem. I'd rather have the problem of excessive growth. How do you tame it? How do you deal with it? We're trying to get up to a few more decimal points. So I think the important point here is there are two important surveys that came out in the last 2 days. from the Reserve Bank and also from Nedbank, and where they made three or four points which I think are all converging on the debate that we're having. Firstly, the different parts of our economy are recovering at different rates. For example, mining, agriculture, exports looking very good, transport and indeed tourism and others are going to take much longer to recover. The macro outcome will be between 3.5% and 4%. I think that's more or less where the consensus forecast is settling at the moment as a rebound. Then I think the second point that comes through from these last two surveys, both from the Reserve Bank and Nedbank, is there's still a level of high uncertainty, as we reported in our Northwest University Business School Index last week. There are risks to these forecasts. There are a number of risks, even globally. And Nedbank has spoken, we've mentioned and stressed, that is the weakness in fixed capital formation, which needs to underpin this recovery and translate it into sustained growth in South Africa. And then finally, they all agreed, and we had some better news this morning when we spoke to Savros about the rollout of the vaccine. So if you look at the forecasts of the Reserve Bank on the rollout, that's why I asked that question. They think that by the end of this year, we may only have perhaps inoculated 15 or perhaps 20% of the population. Hopefully they may now be wrong. And they think it'll be 67% by the middle of next year. So what we're really saying is these numbers are telling us, yes, there is a strong rebound. It's still brittle and needs to be supported by whatever growth plans and indeed the health decisions that we have to take. Those three V's I also mentioned and we discussed. For the next few months, it's vaccine vigilance and indeed lender outreach of infrastructure, at least the Fulandela, outreach of our growth plan. These things all come together even better than what we are forecasting at the moment.
The three V's, the one V we're not seeing in markets at the moment, Warwick, is volatility. Volatility has been very subdued in markets over the last while. And in fact, things are really so frothy that you're seeing stories like Nutritional Holdings and Canacrypt, which, I mean, if you look at it, this story, and we're waiting feedback from the JSE, we've gone to Andre Fisser to find out how the JSE can allow this. But effectively, what you've got is the directors who are bypassing the listing requirements of the JSE to raise funds via an initial coin offering of Canacrypt. When they can't issue a prospectus, they can't come to the market and do it in a formal way. And I can write the headline tomorrow, investors lose millions in unregulated ICO affiliated to a JSE-listed company, if nothing is done. It's a hallmark of being very toppish in a market that has been frothy for some time.
Yes, Michael, I mean, in terms of volatility, it is a double-edged sword. Markets go up and markets go down, and sometimes just because they're going up doesn't necessarily mean everything is all hunky-dory. I don't know particularly any specific details about the Canacrypt ICO or for that matter its relationship with Nutritional Holdings or the prospects of Nutritional Holdings. But what I can say is that whenever one is involved with any kind of crypto, the degree of knowledge and familiarity is of critical importance. It is an unregulated space, basically it's devil take the hindmost. So there is no big brother or regulator or any central authority that's going to take responsibility if your crypto investment goes wrong. So I think that's a sufficient caveat. In relation to that listing, and it's not specific, it's obviously quite generic.
Yeah, we are waiting feedback from the JSE before we can comment further on this, but it certainly raises a number of red flags from my vantage point. Raymond, just to look globally at the other big news in markets, and that's obviously the threat of an overheating US economy, and there's also been a big shift away from growth and momentum towards more value-based investing in the expectations of the rise in inflation. And if you look at it, there's two schools of thought. You've got Jerome Powell and Paul Krugman who are saying, let's go flat out for growth. And you've got Larry Summers and Greg Mankiw saying, we're overheating the economy here. It's being dangerously overdone. Where do you sit in this? Is the U.S. economy at risk here of seriously overheating? What might the impact be for us here in South Africa?
Well, Michael, I think what one could say is that when you look at inflationary expectations, as you've heard, and where there is a debate in the United States about it, there are three sources which you need to get to anchor it. The first is, what are the bond yields saying? What is the market saying about inflation? Well, there was unease a week or two ago. Now there alone seems to be unease. The second is there are household and business surveys of inflation expectations, both in the US and here, in fact, and they are also not expecting inflation immediately. And then thirdly, there's what some of the economists say. There is a division of opinion. So you have two and a half cheers, if you like to put it that way, that for the moment it's not a worrying factor. There are more perhaps differences among those economists about the degree rather than that there will be inflation. But what is the Fed saying? We'll deal with it. In other words, the Fed will, you know, like a stop clock, be right twice a day. There will be inflation. And those who think it's worrying think that they won't be able to deal with it when it comes. So I think it's really too early to say. On the whole, the world, I think, wants to see China and the United States grow. In fact, if you look at the EU, they're not performing. They are indeed one of the laggards, but it will be positive growth. Also, I want to make some of these measures, or most of these measures, that will lead to a check being paid out to all the consumers there quite soon. Firstly, it's only there for a year or two, and then those support measures fall away. Secondly, the infrastructural plan, which is a very important part of the support plan, is spread over 8 to 10 years. So I think, once again, it's manageable. It is uncharted territory because the size of the stimulus is the largest that's ever been undertaken in the United States. So I think it's now a question of good luck and good management to see whether we can get the benefits of that. I recall that when, for example, Janet Yellen was being confirmed by the Senate, she was asked about the dollar. She said, the market must determine the dollar, and if that means a weak dollar, so be it. I will not intervene, the Fed will not intervene. So for the moment, that's what's also pushing the rand up. Mm. But bear in mind, there are two blades to the rand scissors. It's what we also do domestically that will decide the longer term trend in the rand. So we must get our house in order as much as we want to enjoy the benefits of a weak dollar.
Yeah, they certainly call the rand the rattler for a reason, because it can come back and bite you. And I recall many market commentators calling it closer to 19, perhaps then 14, where we find ourselves currently. That's where we're going to have to leave it this week. That was Professor Raymond Parsons of the Northwest University School of Business, and Warwick Lucas, Chief Investment Officer at Galileo Asset Managers, with the Week in Review.